Well, thank you very much for inviting me to come down. It's given me a good excuse to have a, I'm at Carnegie for a month in Pasadena. Give me a good excuse to come down and enjoy Santa Barbara for a weekend. Okay, what I want to talk to you about is a project that's been running now for a few years that I'm involved in and these other folks are involved in, using planetary nebulae. It started using planetary nebulae as dynamical probes of the outsides of galaxies. Hey, Farah, how are you?
Sorry,
no worries. Yeah, it started using planetary nebulae for galactic dynamics purposes because they're very good for studying kinematics in the outer parts of galaxies. But then, just by accident, in the mid-90s, we found some intergalactic planetaries in the Virgo cluster, just free-floating planetaries, and that's developed into quite an industry, and I want to tell you a bit about that. Okay. Fritz Zwicky, I think, was probably the first to at least put in writing the idea of a stellar population between the galaxies in clusters. He'd seen this thing in coma. Not everybody believed it, but I think, as usual, Zwicky was, not as usual, but as often, Zwicky was right about this one, that there really is quite a lot of starlight between the galaxies. And okay, well, as I say, Zwicky found this in the early 50s. There was quite a lot of work done during the 70s, photographic work, looking for diffuse light in coma and other rich clusters. And some of that was actually very impressive work. In coma, the diffuse light is actually quite bright, and it's certainly within the realm of photographic detection. And then starting around 1990, there's been a lot of work. Gary Bernstein and others have done quite a lot of more quantitative work on this. The difficulty with studying the inter-cluster stellar medium is that the diffuse light is actually pretty faint. Even in coma, it's only around 1% of the sky brightness, which you can handle. And it's often, the other point is that it's often rather difficult, and in fact, even the question may not mean much, how do you disentangle the diffuse light that's associated with the halo of the central CD galaxy and then, on the other hand, the diffuse light in the cluster? And that may not even be a meaningful question. Okay, the origin and properties of diffuse light in clusters. The two theoretical inputs into this whole thing, which hadn't really driven it very hard, but work done by Dave Merritt in the mid-80s, that the intercluster light actually came from the galaxies quite early during the collapse, and its distribution, he predicted, follows pretty closely that of the galaxies. And because the population is so old, the intracluster light would be quite smoothly distributed and actually dynamically well mixed and dynamically quite old. The other picture that's, I think, much more in acceptance now is by Ben Moore and others, who introduced this idea of galaxy harassment and tidal stirring during late infall. Harassment's actually a rather interesting process. It's there's two effects working in harassment. One of them is the fact that you've got a cluster of galaxies with a high velocity dispersion, much higher than the internal dispersion in the galaxies themselves. So you get these very fast encounters, which for a long time were believed not to do anything to the galaxies because they didn't last long enough. But in fact, they do quite a lot to the galaxies, and that was actually known since the mid-60s by work from a guy called Allerdin, who really started the whole merger and interaction process. What happens when you get these fast interactions? They're impulsive. So you put energy into the two galaxies that pass, but the encounter's so quick that you don't see anything happening until the galaxy then re-virializes. Because of this change in energy, the galaxy re-virializes, finishes us up as a more loosely bound system just from this impulsive encounter. And then, of course, it's much more prone to the other part of it, which is the tidal stripping by the potential of the cluster itself. In this harassment picture, the intracluster light can be quite young, and you would expect to have substructure in configuration space and in phase space remaining, and part of our efforts have been to try and see if we can find that substructure. Okay, so harassment, I don't know how well that shows, I can see pretty well here. This galaxy is trailing a stream of material behind it. This is a fairly high velocity dispersion cluster, so this is a harassment situation rather than an interaction. I can see on the screen stuff going past this galaxy out like that. I don't know if it's visible for you guys. But here's one of Ben Moore's pictures about how these fast encounters unbind the galaxies, which are then stripped by the tidal field. And this is one of his pictures of just debris from a galaxy, a 2 megaparsec box, and this stuff just goes right around the galaxy, and it's just delineating the orbit of the galaxy as it's being stripped. So this stuff, because the periods are so long, this is very long-lived stuff. Okay.
Can I ask a
question?
Sure. Well, Merritt's comments, it says that the galaxy cluster collapses, right? So won't this collapse actually enhance these close interactions? And I don't see how it follows that if this ejection was during the collapse, that stops after the collapse, because collapse, as far as I know, brings things together.
It does, yeah, yeah. I unfortunately can't remember the details of exactly what drove Merritt's process, but I know that the outcome was that stuff happens really early with all this stripping of material into the electric medium is a very early process, whereas in Ben's picture it's a much later process. But unfortunately I can't remember I haven't read this in years. So yeah.
Because what you said, the velocity dispersion early on is much slower, and so the
So you're getting more, it's more interactions rather than
well,
these impulsive,
the
impulsive encounters. Yeah, it could be, yeah. Okay, there's been some nice work done over the last few years on simulations of the formation and evolution of clusters. Maybe some of you guys have done some of this. The work I'll mention just briefly is by Jesper Sommer-Larsen and his group. This is stuff that's on AstroPH at the moment. He included a lot of processes. It was basically a lambda CDM concordance model simulation. But he had star formation, chemical evolution prescriptions, radiative cooling, supernova-driven galactic winds, the effects of the metagalactic UV field, thermal conduction in this thing. And I'm not going to show you a lot of pictures from it or go into much detail, but basically what happens is you have star formation occurring in galaxies, followed by merging, harassment, tidal stripping by the cluster potential. And the end effect of this is that you finish up with a dominant CD galaxy near the center of the cluster, surrounded by a bunch of other galaxies and a lot of intracluster light. And they ran several simulations, including ones to match Coma and Virgo. I mean, they're very different clusters. Coma's a rather well-mixed looking thing, and Virgo's far from that. And what they found was that in their models, the intracluster light actually contains between 20 and 40% of the total starlight. So getting on for half the stars are actually in the intracluster medium, and the other half are in the galaxies. The intracluster light formed quite early at the redshift around 3 in their models. Now that's not so, that doesn't sit quite so well with the harassment picture, but they're typically about half a giga year old and the mean age of the stars in the galaxies themselves. The chemical abundance, as you might expect, was actually fairly high. These stars come from galaxies. Near the cluster center, the intergalactic light has close to solar abundance, typically half solar towards the cluster edge. And interestingly enough, the intracluster stars are actually kinematically colder than the galaxies themselves. I still don't quite understand why that happened. Velocity dispersion is typically half of the velocity dispersion of the galaxies. And you might say, okay, well, galaxies and this intracluster light are in the same potential. How can this be? Well, you can do it through Jean's equation with having different density distributions. And in some of their models, the velocity dispersion was actually highly anisotropic. And one interesting thing they've found or predicted, which we have actually seen in the past, and I'll show you just in a second, is that the velocity dispersion for the intracluster light, as you go out from the center of the cluster, it actually rises to the outer regions of the CD and then starts to fall. And we actually saw something like this in the Fornax cluster. Now Fornax is a strange little cluster. It's rather compact. It has an unusually low velocity dispersion. The velocity dispersion of the galaxies is actually only around 400. And that's rather similar to the velocity dispersion at the center of the CD galaxy itself, NGC 3099. So this is not a typical situation by any means, but it is one where we do have a fair amount of data. And this is a composite of data from all sorts of people. There's a couple of planetary nebula points on here. And so what's happening here, we're measuring radius out from the center of NGC 3099, which is a very substantial CD galaxy, X-ray emitter and all sorts of stuff. Okay, so in the center of the galaxy, you have a velocity dispersion around 400. And these are all integrated light points coming down here. And you see the dispersion drops as we go out of the CD. Now, we haven't gone very far. We've only gone out to a few tens of arc seconds. And then it starts to turn again. And this is the sort of thing that Sommer Larsen, I think, was predicting. You see the velocity dispersion going up. These are, again, a mixture of points from planetary nebulae globular clusters. And then you get into the Fornax cluster itself. And out here, we're looking at galaxies. And as I say, it's really hard to know where the envelope of the CD finishes and the galaxies start. And I don't know if it's a very meaningful question even. But here's what happens. Velocity dispersion goes back up to about what it was in the center of the CD. And then now we get into the cluster galaxies and it starts to dribble off again. There has been some work done on intercluster planetaries, including by people in this room, but the Fornax work hasn't got as far as the Virgo work for a whole bunch of reasons, which I can talk about later.
Is this the only cluster where you see this behavior?
It's the only one I'm aware of so far, yeah. Virgo is different. I mean, for some reason, there still isn't good planetary nebula data in the outer parts of the Virgo cluster. It's coming, but it's been coming for a long time. It just hasn't actually come. So, I mean, one could do this in Virgo, but the situation in Virgo is going to be quite different because these galaxies are going to be up around 800. So you'll come out of the M87, go down, and then you'll come up, and it'll go up a long way, and I don't know really what will happen after that. So it will be a different situation, but that's for the future. Okay, well, this talks about planetary nebulae. Why use planetary nebulae as tracers? Well, the reason is that they are actually part of just any normal stellar population. Stars of less than about 4 solar masses go through a planetary nebula phase as they die. So things like the Sun go through it. So it's just there's nothing unusual about planetary nebulae. They just happen to be nice things to observe. Here's some pretty pictures from the Hubble Heritage Collection. And these are the kinds of things we're looking at, but of course much, much further away. And the reason we can study these things so far away is that about 20% of the energy of that central star comes out for a period of order 10 to the 5 years in a single line, the 5007 angstrom oxygen 3 line. And because there's so much energy coming out of one line, it actually makes them pretty easy to detect. And there's no serious problem about picking these things up as individual objects out to 20 megaparsecs. And right at the end of the talk, I'll tell you about some work we've done in the Coma cluster, where we're actually finding these things 100 megaparsecs out. Okay, so we detect them with narrowband surveys in regions where the integrated surface brightness of the diffused light is much too low to be detected. And the other joy of them, of course, is because you've got a line, you can measure radial velocity. The downside of planetary nebulae is that when you do these sort of narrowband surveys to find these emission line objects, you have a background of what is contaminants for this problem. Of course, it's somebody else's breakfast, but it's these things. These Lyman alpha emitters at a redshift, it just happens to be pi when you're working in the Virgo cluster. And to really eliminate these things, you have to have some extra piece of information, like, for example, images in another narrow band, like H alpha, if we'd surveyed in oxygen 3, or if you've got spectra, you can pick them up because they're pretty broad lined usually. And so you need some way of checking that the candidates that you've got are really planetary nebulae and not these Lyman alpha emitters.
What's the breakdown between the two
populations? I'll show you that just in a second. It's rather location dependent. In Virgo, after about the first magnitude of the planetary nebula luminosity function, you're swamped by these Lyman alpha things. Yeah. Okay, so this is kind of how the imaging story goes. Here are just three images of a particular planetary nebula. Here's a spectrum. That's in oxygen 3. You can see it nicely. In H alpha, it's still there but weak. In the continuum, it's not there at all. And here's the reason why, is you can see from the spectra, this is the oxygen 3 line, very strong. And then you've got a few other lines as we go along. That's night sky, that's not a real one. And then you've got a weakish H alpha here. So H alpha provides a nice check that you've got a planetary nebula. This is one way of doing it. It may not be the most efficient way. So they're great kinematical traces. Typically, you get about 50 of these things per unit of absolute magnitude equal to minus 18. So say a smallish elliptical galaxy, absolute magnitude minus 18, will have about 50 of these things in the first 2.5 magnitudes of the luminosity function. And there's no serious problem if you've got a good spectrograph, which we don't, in measuring velocities to about 20 kilometers a second with 4-meter telescopes at the distance of 20 megaparsecs. Now, at the moment, nobody has really successfully done this with 4-meter telescopes. Lots of people have tried, and we're all just working around the fringe. At the moment, you really need 8-meter telescopes. But if we had spectrographs on 4-meter telescopes, or the quality of the ones you get on 8-meter telescopes, we could do this. Okay, so it's just a little example of some planetary nebulae. I'm just going to show you what spectra look like. Here is the Sombrero. We did a survey some years ago. These green things are all planetary nebulae in the Sombrero, but the point is, I just wanted to show you this. This is a whole bunch of fiber spectra taken with the AAT. Now, the Sombrero's 10 megaparsecs away, and that's really easy. Each line is the spectrum of a single fiber. Fibers are put on the locations of these planetary nebulae, and here's the oxygen 3 line, this thing going down here. There's another oxygen 3 line going down here that you might see in some of the really bright ones. That's the second line. The fact that they're not all lined up, that's just the velocity dispersion of the outer parts of the Sombrero. So that's kind of what this sort of data looks like.
Are you getting continuum, or is that sky?
That's sky, yeah. There's no continuum worth having. It's sky plus galaxy background, probably more galaxy background than actually sky. Okay, so there's another technique that we've developed over the years. It's called slitless counter-dispersed spectroscopy. And we're doing this more and more now with the 8-meter telescopes. What I'm going to show you comes from FORS-1 at the VLT. So what we do there, we have a spectrograph, no slit, so we're just using the thing wide open. We put a narrowband filter behind it, and we take a spectrum of a piece of the sky. So all of these things, these little short spectra, are stars, or the fuzzy ones are galaxies. Okay. When we get a planetary nebula, you just get a dot. There's one. There's another. There's another. And there's another. And that dot just comes because the only thing in this band is an emission line. There's no continuum worth having. So that's the spectrum you've taken. Now you turn the spectrograph after you've done this. You turn the spectrograph 180 degrees on the sky. Okay. Everything reverses except the dispersion. Dispersion is still in the same sense, but now you've flipped the sky around. Okay, now you take that one, flip it around back in the computer, and locate it. And this is the kind of thing you'll see. So here's one. Okay. So just have a look, for example, at this thing and this thing. You'll see them moving. Okay? And the difference in position, which is really just wavelength here, is twice the velocity relative to the center of the passband of the filter. You register these things on the stellar spectra. So this is an easy way of finding them and measuring their velocities all in one go. Well, it's not easy. It takes a long time, but it's very direct. So you don't have to go through the process of making two time applications, going through the hassle of finding these things, doing the astrometry, then going off later. So we're doing this quite a lot. Okay, but going back to the narrow band stuff, here's where we've got to in Virgo. We've used a number of telescopes. ESO 2.2 meter has done very well for us. CTIO and Kitt Peak 4 meters, and this one is actually a different image from the Subaru Supreme Cam imager. Here's Virgo. That's about 12 degrees of Virgo, and these are the various fields that we've already surveyed and found planetary nebulae in. And the thing that's coming out of that, in particular, is that in Virgo, the number density is very inhomogeneous. In some fields, we find a lot of planetary nebulae. Others, where we should find lots, we don't get any. Even within fields, the distribution is clearly inhomogeneous. And this just gives you some sense. Just have a look at this one. This gives you some sense of how much the numbers of planetary nebulae are flipping around. So in fact, here, in the inner parts of the cluster, we're not finding a lot. And there's a couple of fields out here where we actually do get a lot. Okay, so at least the expectation that one might get from the harassment picture does appear to be borne out. And there's a field down here which has been deeply surveyed and weren't any planetary nebulae in it at all. Not a single one. Lots of Lyma alphas. Okay. Other things that have come out of this that are sort of interesting. The Virgo cluster is clearly pretty elongated along the line of sight. The front edge of it, just from the planetary nebulae brightnesses, is about 15% closer to us than M87 itself. So it's about 2 megaparsecs closer to us. This answers Jason's question, I think. Yeah, this is, it doesn't quite, sorry. This shows the luminosity function of the planetary nebulae as opposed to in the field, as opposed to the luminosity function of the ones in M87. So this is a different slide. So you can see how these ones are actually substantially closer than the M87 planetaries. Okay, mean surface brightness of the intracluster light in Virgo. Now, so far nobody succeeded in actually imaging this, and the reason is that the integrated surface brightness of this intracluster light is really, really faint. It's around 29.5, and that's pretty much out of reach. About 10% of the starlight in Virgo is in the intracluster medium. We thought this number was rather higher a few years ago, but it's coming down as we're getting better at excluding these Lyman alphas. Okay, so in summary, at the moment, it looks as though we've also done the LEO group, that was the Castro work, and we basically didn't find any planetary nebulae at all in the LEO group, which is a compactish group, not very compact, but fairly. About 10% in Virgo, as I mentioned, and it's above 20% in the rich clusters.
What do you think this number is? What scale do you refer to? Where is the edge of the cluster, say?
Okay, well, with Virgo, the data is all pretty much in the inner parts. So we then had to assume that the intercluster... maybe a little more, but still pretty much inner. And then we just had to assume that the intracluster light was distributed like the galaxies and just use that as a normalizing thing. Okay, Okay, so I'm going to just go on just for a moment on kinematics of what we see in Virgo, but this is just some wonderful spectra that have come from the flames system on the VLT. These are truly spectacular. We've been hanging out for a system like this for years and years and years, and finally it's come. What you need for this kind of work is a resolution ideally around 10,000, because the intrinsic lines of the planetaries are very, very narrow, so up to about 10,000, the more resolution you have, the better you do against the sky. And here with these, I mean, you can actually see the two oxygen 3 lines. I've actually marked these up here. That's the 5007 line. It's got this little second line that always goes with it, about a third of the strength. And when you see that, you know that there's no question about it. You've got a planetary nebula. You haven't got a Lyman alpha. And here's a Lyman alpha emitter, a great wide thing. Okay, so just a quick summary of what we've got so far with the kinematics. Where to start? Okay, this is like the core of Virgo, this field here. And you can see that's like a degree there. So all of these fields are pretty much within the core, but that's right at the core. Now, in the core region, the planetaries we've got from flames cover pretty much the same range of velocities as the galaxies. So it corresponds to a velocity dispersion of about 800 kilometers a second. Now down here, this is a field we surveyed with Subaru, and this was a bit of a disaster area because it turned out that almost all the planetaries were associated with M84 or M86 itself, which are these two galaxies. And you can see a much, much narrower distribution. Here is the field out in the outer parts of M87, and you can see again a rather narrow velocity dispersion, about 180 kilometers a second, right at the very close to mean velocity of M87 itself. And this one, I think, does answer Jason's question. No, it doesn't. Sorry, I'm still on the wrong one. Sorry, I've got it here somewhere. The thing I want to show you is just how the luminosity functions of planetaries and Lyman alphas go. I hope it's there. I thought that was it.
Ken, in your previous slide, when you were showing the spectrum from the Large Planetary Nebula, you didn't have continuum either. I don't see
no,
the zero even with that you have.
Yeah.
You can't distinguish everything is zero continuum.
Yeah, there's the planetary nebulae continua are really, really faint. There's nothing to see. Yeah. Okay, so, all right, so this is what we've got at the moment for planetary nebulae. It's a fairly useless slide, but it's just the distribution of all the velocities we've got. And see, Virgo goes right down to, well, it goes down to minus a few hundred. So I don't know what these things are. That may be something that's got in there that we haven't properly excluded. But anyway, the mean velocity is very close to Virgo. Dispersion, when you take them all together, is a little bit lower than the dispersion for the galaxies themselves, which is 800. All right, so summary of results for Virgo. Using the narrow band imaging techniques, where we use two lines, O3 and H alpha, the fraction of spectroscopically confirmed planetary nebulae is now about 70%. So if we think that something's a planetary nebula from the narrow band surveys, then we have a 70% chance of being right. We still get a bit of Lyman alpha stuff coming through. The fraction of Lyman alpha emitters in the spectroscopically confirmed sample agrees pretty well for what you expect from blank field surveys that a lot of other people have done. Okay, giant galaxies like M87 are very extended. We find planetary nebulae belonging to M87 out to beyond 100 kiloparsecs from the center of M87. And that's why I say it's really hard and maybe meaningless to work out whether something in the outer parts of M87 is part of M87 or part of the medium. And the velocity histograms show strong field-to-field variations, suggesting that Virgo is dynamically pretty young. Okay, now I want to just mention a little bit of work we've been doing in the coma cluster. So something that we just started this year. Story goes like this, that when you have dense, well-mixed clusters like coma, the diffuse light can be very high. There's a survey by Crick and Bernstein, not much in the way of details. This is Rebecca rather than Gary, but they find between 5 and 50% of starlight. And you get similar fractions in some of the compact groups. Hickson 90 was one example. And on the other hand, in some groups like Leo, where you might expect to get intercluster planets, you just don't find a thing. Okay. But the coma is the one that Zwicky originally looked at. It's a long way out. It's about 7,000 kilometers out, close to 100 megaparsecs from us. Distance modulus about 35. And the intercluster light in this system is somewhere between 30 and 50% of the total. And that's work that goes back into the 70s from Twine and Cormody and G. Bernstein in 95. The peak surface brightness of this is actually, you can actually image this stuff, and it's around 26 B magnitudes per square second. So that's about 1% of the sky. It corresponds to about 3 solar luminosities per square parsec. So it's quite a bit of light. And coma would be a very nice candidate for really studying the intracluster light in a well-mixed cluster, if we could just find a way of measuring planetaries at 90 megaparsecs. And as I've been mentioning before, the previous studies really only extend out to Virgo distances around 20 megaparsecs. So that's like pretty much four magnitudes closer. Well, it turns out there is a way. Well, just let me show you this, though. This is the Cormody and Twine, the Twine and Cormody isophotometry of the intracluster light in coma. This is photographic stuff, but it appears to be very good. And the contours go from about 25.5 to 27 in B, so this is getting pretty faint. But you can even in this picture, you can pretty much actually see the intracluster light, and you can see how they stop their isophotometry here. It gets too difficult. But okay, so what I'm going to show you next is, or soon, is some work that we did in this area here, just under there. Okay, so the techniques we've used so far, just recapping, there's narrow band imaging through a filter 50 to 100 angstroms wide, and it has to be this wide to get the cluster's velocity spread. And this works fine at 17 megaparsecs, but at 90 megaparsecs, the planetaries have become so faint that they're absolutely lost in the sky background. And even if we could find them, we still have to measure velocities, and at the moment, we need 8-meter telescopes and multi-object spectrographs to do this, even at Virgo. As I mentioned earlier, if we had decent spectrographs and 4-meter telescopes, we could do this. The other technique we've used is slitless counter-dispersed spectroscopy through a narrow band filter. you get detection of velocity simultaneously, but again, just like with this, the sky background is a killer. So we have to find some other way of doing it. And Ortwin Gerhardt had an idea which I think has been around, other people have used, but it's certainly the first time it's been used for planetaries. Somehow you've got to suppress the sky background to get these planetaries. So what we tried doing was make a full field multi-slit. So what I mean by full field multi-slit, the usual multi-slits that people use for studying galaxies and cosmology, you've got a field and you have a lot of little short slits that you put on top of galaxies. What we did was just make a full field multi-slit. So you have slits going right through, then you have a gap and you have another one and another one and another one. So imagine that this, you're looking at this thing sideways. It comes out at you like this. So you've got long slits going along this way, and the light's falling on them. You pass that through a narrowband filter, and then your spectrograph, and each multi-slit, or each slit of the multi-slit, gives you a passband in the camera, the focal plane of the camera. So each one of these gives you a passband, but of course that passband comes right out towards you in space. Okay? And the point of doing this is that normally we don't have this multi-slit in here, and we get all that skylight, and this suppresses the skylight down to, or it suppresses it by a factor of 7. Now, of course, you pay a penalty for it because you're not surveying anything where you've got bits of metal here. But a thing like the one we use actually surveys 14% of the area of the field, so 86% is covered by metal. And the slits we used were just quite narrow things, they're 0.6 of a second wide and 6 minutes long, very long things. And we did this with Subaru, the focus spectrograph, just a fairly standard multi-object spectrograph. Okay, so this is the size of the Subaru field. That's the coma cluster. They're those isophotes we had before, so we're just sitting down in the field like that. And this worked. It's extraordinary. Couldn't believe it. We had a great night. We actually had a few great nights. But so what you're seeing here is the partly reduced data, a little messy to interpret, but the slits are actually running along here in this direction. Wavelength goes that way, so each one of these things is the passband of the filter for a single slit, and then here's the next slit, here's the next slit. So there's a galaxy, just this little short piece of spectrum. It happened to be in this multi-slit, in this particular slit. That's a galaxy spectrum. Here's another one, here's another one. This thing I put a ring around is a planetary nebula, 90 megaparsecs away. And it comes through very nicely. And you can tell there's so much enough resolution here to tell whether you've got a planetary nebula or a Lyman alpha, because the Lyman alphas become quite broad.
Do you end up with zero order images on your reflector?
No, they're way off. Okay, so this is just a slightly expanded version of a couple of these planetary nebulae. This length is just the PSF of the spectrograph. Even an unresolved thing is as long as that. So again, wavelength. So this is position along the slit. All we've actually properly analyzed so far is just one field and one good night. It was a very spectacular night that got down to 4/10 of a second seeing. But we got 9 planetaries and 11 Lyman alphas. And Lyman alphas are slightly more than pi this time, 3.2. As I mentioned, these are a contaminant for us, but they're less of a problem for these spectroscopic surveys because you can easily tell them, because the Lyman alpha lines are typically 10 angstroms wide. Okay, so this was really just a feasibility test that we did, but it does really appear that it is feasible to investigate the kinematics of the intercluster light, the stars of it, in the coma cluster out of 90 megaparsecs using planetary nebulae. As I said, our multi-slit area is actually a seventh of the field, so if we just offset these things 7 times, we pretty much cover the entire area that's shown. This would take us, if the seeing is really good like it was on that particular night, we could do actually 2 mask positions per night. But to really survey the inter-cluster field and coma would take a lot of telescope time. Of course, you don't always get conditions like that. And the conditions make an amazing difference, if anyone has ever tried doing anything like this would know. What you can do in 5/10 of a seeing, you can, it's 5/10 of a second seeing, you can forget about it if it's 8/10. Okay, well look, I'll just keep talking for just a tiny bit, if I may, on something completely different. And if the fire alarm goes, well, so be it. Okay, just a very few slides here. I just want to tell you a little bit about another machine that we've built to do this sort of planetary nebula work. Goes back to this idea of counter dispersed slitless spectroscopy. So this is really more about galaxies than clusters. And a couple of us were sort of thinking about this in parallel and got together and put together a machine. And as I mentioned to you, we've had several successful VLT and FORS runs using this sort of counter dispersed slitless spectroscopy. And so the principle clearly works. And with the FORS one, I think I said this too, that we took observations in two position angles, one integration, turned the spectrograph 180 degrees, rotate one image in the computer 180 degrees, superimpose them on the stellar spectra, separation of the planetary nebula images gives you a measure of the velocity, and of course you get the flux for free. There's no slits in this, so you don't have any slit losses. Okay, so we decided to try and build a machine that would do all this in one go, so we wouldn't have to turn it. And what we do, it's a very basic slitless spectrograph. This is, so light comes in here. This section is just a collimator. There's a narrowband filter here. And then we do a split at this point. These are two gratings. So you just split the pupil. They're sitting in the pupil of the spectrograph. You split the pupil, and half the light goes one way, half the light goes the other way. And the advantage this has over having a single spectrograph that you turn is if the weather conditions change during the exposure. I mean, these exposures typically take a night. Weather conditions change. If you had better conditions in one position angle than the other, then of course it impairs what you're doing. The other advantage of making a machine like this, it's nobody else uses it, so you can, it just does one job at 5,007 angstroms. You can get these amazing optical coatings that where you basically don't lose any light in the optics at all except for the grating. So this, you can make an exceedingly efficient device, and that's, well, we built this thing and it actually works. So
total throughput's a half or something?
33%. It's including detector. Yeah. So here's just a bit of stuff on it. It actually, for various historical reasons that malfunctioned, we decided to put this thing at La Palma, and we negotiated with both the Herschel telescope and the Italian telescope people to use it on both. So we designed a compromise instrument. They're both F11, but they have rather different field curvatures. And this turns out to have been a big mistake because various things went wrong at the TNG, and we've never got this thing on the TNG. So we're basically using this on the Herschel telescope. Measured throughput, everything from the outside the from the top of the telescope to the data is 33%.
Resolution
is about an angstrom, 2 pixel resolution is about an angstrom. For a slitless device, you don't win by going to higher resolution, because you're getting all the sky on top of you anyway. And that was, so we just took a resolution that would give us the velocity precision we wanted. But you get a big field with these things. It's typically around 10 minutes, 11 minutes. It's actually a little worse than I said. But it's plenty of resolution for getting velocities. Okay, so there it is. It's painted in oxygen 3 green. And that's the machine. So that's the collimator section. Grating sit here. There's the two cameras and the two detectors. And this thing's had a lot of time on the telescope. Works pretty well. So here's just an example of what kind of stuff you get out of it. This is just a test field we did in M31. So compare, this is the left arm and the right arm. So there's the planetary nebula. You can see how its position is moved relative to the star, and you can probably see a few others dotted around the field. So the thing works just like you'd expect. It's doing all the right things. So I'll just close with just a tiny bit on the main program we've been doing with this thing, which has been on intermediate luminosity ellipticals, galaxies that are fainter than about minus 20. And the goal was to try and study these things at large radii, pick up the planetary nebulae, and try and get some constraints on their dark matter content, because at the time when we built this thing, and I think probably still now, not much is known about dark matter content of these intermediate luminosity ellipticals. Lots known about dwarf spheroidals, the little, really little ones, a lot known about the CDs. But these intermediate luminosity ones were almost untouched. So these are just some planetaries that turned up, and they're just color-coded, red for positive velocities, blue for negative ones. So you can see straight away there's not much rotation in this system. It's all pretty well mixed with red and blue. This is the surprise that came out of it. Shouldn't have been a surprise, but I'll tell you why, but it was. So this is NGC 3379. It's the famous elliptical in LEO. Everybody uses it as a standard elliptical when they're doing photometry. We've managed to get out to 6 effective radii in this thing, which is a long way out. Effective radius is the half-life radius. Here's the run of projected velocity dispersion. Runs down like this. And 2 models have been fitted. This is just an isotropic model with constant mass to light, so your density distribution just follows the light. You see that fits pretty well. And here's a similar thing with the stars, but with an added flat rotation curve potential to represent the dark matter. And you see with this thing, out to 6 effective radii, you really have no compelling reason to think that there's any dark matter in this thing at all, which is pretty bizarre, given how much dark matter there is in brighter and fainter ellipticals. This is the best one we've got, but there are 2 others where the data perhaps goes as far as this. And the indications are very similar. I don't actually know what to think about this. There's
How many kiloparsecs is that?
I'll tell you offhand. It's probably 25, something like that. That may not be right. Here it is. Yeah, okay. So this is just another way of looking at the same thing. This is the circular velocity as a function of radius in this galaxy that you would expect if the mass follows light with constant m over l. And that's just, again, just to show that there's not a sort of a flat rotation curve. And this is the region of fit. And that's a very normal sort of m over l ratio. So the implications of this are that if there is dark matter, it lies mainly out beyond 6 effective radii. That may not be such a surprise if these things are really all merger products. Alternatively, it could be that while we're used to thinking of the large ellipticals as being, you know, things that are built up by many, many mergers of probably spirals bringing in a lot of dark matter, it is conceivable, though I don't think very likely, it's conceivable that these intermediate luminosity ellipticals form by processes that are primarily baryonic, in the sort of same way as globular clusters do. And globular cluster formation appears just to be a baryonic thing. There's no evidence at all for dark matter in globular clusters. And it is conceivable that the formation process of these intermediate luminosity ellipticals is just a different kind of process. But I guess as time goes on, we'll learn more about that. And that's it. Thank you.
Additional questions?
I want their lunch.
If you look at the isotropy, can you say something about whether the orbits are isotropic,
kind of isotropic? No, not from data like this. We have to get much, much better data. We actually have to get velocity profiles at particular places to get any sort of handle on the isotropy. Yeah, for the intercluster light, he had some models that were highly anisotropic, quite radially elongated, and others that came out quite isotropic. So it was, I think, just the luck of what happened. You know, as the things came together, so.
Quiet today.
They're hungry. I can hear it.
I already asked my question. Well, let's thank Ken again, and